Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Back to another episode. Today I'm going to be continuing my survey of the Star Trek film franchise with Star Trek Generations. Before I get to that, I want to do a little bit of sci-fi news. I don't have any feedback this week due to the fact that I'm kind of jumping the gun on this podcast and haven't gotten anything since I did the last one. A little bit of genre news, not much. I saw something about the Westworld TV show. They talked about that a little earlier, that Jonathan Nolan was back filming and writing and they had taken a hiatus. But HBO said that the first 10 episodes are going to drop in the fall of this year. And everyone was thinking that probably not till next year, but it is in fact going to drop in the fall. So only maybe 3 months, 4 months away from a Jonathan Nolan Westworld. So very interested in seeing what Jonah Nolan has in store for us there. And the only other bit of news that I picked up was the information that the Halloween franchise is going to sort of be revamped to a certain degree, and that Mr. John Carpenter himself will be at the production helm of whatever new Halloween is. He's not going to direct it, but he's going to produce it. So I'm kind of mixed on that. I don't think John Carpenter's made a good movie since, God, even before Vampires, you know? Like, I'm trying to remember the last movie. Probably the two movies that he did in quick succession, a remake of Village of the Damned, which I'll probably cover at some point, and In the Mouth of Madness. I like both of those films. They were flawed, but they were, like, good Carp films. And then I don't think he's done anything since then that I cared at all about. You know, The Ward, Ghosts of Mars, Vampires, like, all these films. The last thing that I really liked other than his movies was he did a couple of short films for Masters of Horror, I think. One called Cigarette Burns and then Pro-Life. And they were both pretty good, like had his feel to them, which was absent, has been absent in his films for a while. So I don't know that Carp anymore has the faculties to like put out a really good movie. So even if he's producing Halloween, I don't know that I care. Like, I don't, you know, because it's not like the Halloween franchise has been so terrible and that he's going to whip it back into shape. Like, the zombie movies were okay. You know, the first zombie movie was pretty good in terms of, you know, an earnestness behind it. You know, the second one, I don't know if I've seen the second one, but so I don't know. I'm a little mixed about it. Like, I love Carp and I'm like, he's one of my favorite directors of all time, but I'm not rosy cheeked about Carp. Like, you know, his stuff can be a mess as well. I don't know. Very curious to see if that's just all BS and it's gone in a month, or what would a Halloween look like coming out under his guidance. So anyway, thought that was interesting. All right, so let's get to some background about Star Trek Generations. After the release of The Undiscovered Country in 91, it was expected that the next Trek feature film would feature the cast of Next Gen. Paramount executives approached the Next Gen producer, Rick Berman, in 92 about creating a feature film 4 months before the official announcement. Berman informed Ron Moore and Brandon Braga that Paramount had approved a two-picture deal about midway through the Next Gen sixth season. So Moore and Braga, who were convinced Berman had called them into his office to tell them that Next Gen was canceled, instead found Berman asking them to write one of the Star Trek films. Writers spent weeks with Berman developing the story before taking a working vacation in May 93 to write the first draft screenplay, completed June 1st. Moore described Generations as a project with a number of required elements that the film, quote, had to have. Berman felt that included the original cast of the previous films. Felt like a good way to pass the baton to the next series. The studio wanted the original cast to only appear in the first minutes, with Kirk only reoccurring at the end of the film. Other requests included a big Khan Noonien Singh-like antagonist, Klingons, and a humorous Data plot. In the initial draft of the screenplay, the original series cast appeared in the prologue, and Guinan served as the bridge between the two generations. The opening shot would have been the entire original series cast crammed into an elevator aboard the Enterprise B, happy to be back together. The Enterprise D's end also appeared. The saucer crash had first been proposed as the cliffhanger for Moore's original seventh season finale, All Good Things, which eventually became the series finale. Kirk's death was initially developed in Braga, Moore, and Berman's story sessions. Moore recalled that, quote, "We wanted to aim high, do something different and big. We knew we had to have a strong Picard story arc. So what are the profound things in a man's life he has to face? Mortality tops the list," end quote. After the idea of killing off a next-gen cast member was vetoed, someone suggested that Kirk die instead. Moore recalled that, quote, "We all sort of looked around and said, that might be it." Refining the script also meant facing the realities of budget constraints. The initial proposal included location shooting in Hawaii, Idaho, and the Midwestern U.S., and the budget was over $30 million. After negotiations, the budget was reduced to $25 million. It's amazing to think of these numbers nowadays, you know? So Nimoy turned down the chance to direct the feature as well as reprise the role of Spock. He was originally asked to act in film and direct it, but he declined after reading the script and being told it was not time to fix the parts with which he had problems. According to Nimoy, there was a character named Spock in the script, but the lines were so bland they could have been spoken by anyone. Those lines were given to James Doohan as Scotty. Nimoy later pointed to this as proof he was right. DeForest Kelly was set to appear in the movie as Dr. Leonard Bones McCoy, but due to his declining health, he could not get on-set insurance, a union requirement for anyone on a film set. Thought that was interesting. His lines were then later given to Walter Koenig as Chekhov. The producers asked George Takei to come back and play Sulu and take the helm of the Enterprise B, but Takei refused because if Sulu had taken the helm, it would have meant temporarily reducing Sulu's rank so that he could serve under Captain Kirk again. He felt that Sulu had worked too hard to earn his command to allow even a temporary reduction. Which is like amazing to think about, right? A new character, Damora, daughter of Sulu, was then created to speak Sulu's lines. So that very interesting. Producers chose David Carson as the director, who is a television director for the most part. Had never done a feature film. He himself was surprised at the choice. He had directed several episodes of Star Trek, including Yesterday's Enterprise, the Deep Space Nine double-length plot Emissary. So I guess he had some chops in terms of feature-length stuff. But so that's the background. So let's get into the film itself. So a little bit of trivia here. I'm going to try to thread the trivia into the film as it pertains to the scenes rather than wait until the end, trying something different this time around. This movie was supposed to have started with Kirk making an orbital skydive and Chekhov and Scotty running to meet him when he lands on the ground to inform him that he has to be on the new Enterprise B for its launching ceremony. And the scene was shot but cut from the final film. So kind of interesting. So we start off, you know, in space. And with the credits and these wonderful... Dennis McCarthy, by the way, did the music for this film, and it's beautiful stuff. The soundtrack to Generations is really... I highly recommend you pick it up. Some of the most beautiful Star Trek music you've heard in a motion picture. Really wonderful. So we start slowly. We see the champagne bottle tumbling end over end, and we get really close, and it's Dom Perignon. I think it's dated 2265, which is kind of funny. And the credits end when it impacts the Enterprise B, which is being christened for launch. So now we cut to the Enterprise B bridge, and a whole, you know, gaggle of reporters are clustered around Kirk, Chekhov, and Scotty, who enter the bridge. We also meet the John Harriman, who's the captain of the Enterprise B, who's played by this actor who played Cameron in First Bueller's Day Off, so kind of funny to see him. And Shatner already, from the beginning, is in fine form here. Like, he really looks good. He's not mugging too much, you know? Like, he's really getting into the gravity of the scene. He still has a wonderful air of command about him in this. I mean, he walks on the bridge, you know, and everyone around him, it's like the man, you know, like Kirk he's there indelibly. So it's really great. He has a really good presence here. Then we meet Damora Sulu, and he's like surprised that Sulu had a daughter, and we get this tag of the theme. It's going to be in the movie. You know, he's asking Scotty, where did Sulu have time for a family? So that's the beginning of something that'll be, you know, it's a through line through Picard's life as well as Kirk when we meet him later. And there's this moment where they're about to pull out a space dock, and Harriman says, "Gentlemen, if you take your seats..." And Kirk puts his hand on the captain's chair, and he's like, oh, right, right, right. And he goes and he sits in the gallery with with Chekhov and Scotty. It's like, it's very subtle, but really well done. Of course, Harriman plays it up, and he's like, Captain, you know, because all the reporters are on board. You know, they're going to do basically a quick spin around the solar system, so it's kind of like a little training cruise. So all these reporters are on board, and so Harriman basically asks Kirk to give the order to take the ship out. And he denies it, and he denies it, and finally he stands up, and, you know, all these reporters thrust their devices in his face, and he's like, take us out. There's all clapping, and Chekhov leans in, and he goes, very good, sir. And Scotty leans in, and he goes, brought a tear to me eye, and Kirk's like, oh, shut up. So good Trek, you know, good Trek comedy moment right there. We're in such good hands with the writers in terms of knowing the characters. And how they are and how they interact in this film, you know? So I really love that. The photography, the space photography here, all the ships look really good. Like, they really did a great job. I mean, 1994, so, you know, we're getting up there. But still, you know, I've seen some sci-fi films from the 90s that don't look so great. And the ships look really good, really crisp. The effects are really well done here. So we kick off our story. They get the distress call from the ship, the Lacool, stuck in some sort of gravimetric disturbance, you know, and so they have to go in. And there's this wonderful moment where we're really seeing that Harriman is this untested, untried captain, because immediately he's, you know, he's begging off of the rescue, like, oh, we're in no shape for a rescue. And of course, he finds out that there's no other ship in the quadrant. The actor playing Harriman is very good, because you see him just sit down and he reluctantly gives the order to, but the way he even says it too, helm, you know, where he's not eager to engage in this situation. He's very reluctant, and you know, Kirk is constantly standing up, like wanting to jump in and help and do something, and because he's such a, you know, Kirk is Kirk, right? And this young kind of commander is just not, you know, hasn't done anything yet, and so it's a really good contrast of like Kirk being Kirk and being contrasted by this untried guy who's very unsure of himself. So when they close in, we get our first view of the energy ribbon, which is really neat. Tim Russ, who will later play Tuvok in Voyager, is actually on the bridge of the Enterprise B. He plays a bridge officer, so that's kind of cool. It's funny, when they close to a certain distance with the ribbon, you know, they can't get much closer, but the ships are still in danger. And so Kirk like walks by the captain and he's giving him hints. He's like, tractor beam, tractor beam. And we get the little bit of a humor here that the ship is so untested that the tractor beam hasn't been installed. It's going to be installed on Tuesday, and this becomes a recurring trope, which is kind of fun. So then they do this great thing, which I love, where Harriman tries out all these, like, because next generation sort of physics problem solutions, right? Like on the original series, like the only time when things were like got really technical was like when Spock, like maybe once in a while, had to help Scotty fix the engines, and you would hear about some technology they used. But in Next Gen, all the time they were like, we create a subspace pulse if we vent the plasma deflectors and we do the coil, because there was a whole sort of technical advisory committee. I think it's this guy Michael Okuda who heads it, and I think he wrote like the Starfleet manual, the book. So there's like a bunch of guys as part of the Trek franchise that just sit around, and they've come up with all the rules, the sort of, you know, quasi-science rules for the Trek universe, you know. They're the ones who come up with, like, if we do the manifold and the warp deflectors and the trilithium, blah, blah, all that stuff that you hear in Trek films, those guys come up with it. And basically, also what I found out was when guys write Trek scripts, sometimes they'll come up with problems to solve, but they don't know exactly how they're going to be solved. So they'll leave blanks in the script, and the guys will write, like, Geordi, what if we, and they call it tech, right? So he goes, Geordi, what if we tech the tech? And Geordi's like, well, Captain, if we tech the tech, then we'd have to tech the tech. And there are all these blanks in the scripts. And the script is approved. They send it to the technical guys, Michael Okuda and his team, and they come up with the sort of pseudoscience that's going to be used to describe. So when you hear them talking in all this technical language that, you know, it's not real science, but man, it could be, right? It's funny. It's created by, and that's what, it's part of what makes Trek such a wonderful franchise, like that they have this, like they care enough about making it sound realistic, and that these technical devices and these technical things that they come up with, they stay consistent from franchise to franchise, from Next Gen to Voyager. Like, they're all consistent and they come up with new stuff. So all of this to say, Harriman tries a bunch of these, and this all started with Next Gen, by the way. So Harriman tries some of these Next Gen wonder solutions where he's like, what if we create a subspace pulse, a bubble and we'll break them out of this. And what if we vent, you know, warp plasma through the nacelle? And it's great. And so he tries all this stuff, and of course, none of it works. And basically, the great idea here is that, you know, he's trying to stand back and do like a magical fix where he's got to do is like plunge the ship in, get his hands dirty, and save these people. And so eventually, when he runs out of ideas, he looks over to Kirk and he's like, and Kirk's been very respectful. You know, he hasn't said a word, but he's fuming. And he goes, you know, Captain Kirk, I would appreciate any suggestions you might have. And Kirk's like jumps up and he's like, close to within transporter range, beam those people aboard. And, you know, Harriman says, but we don't know what the ship could be in danger. And it's this great line. He looks at him. He's like, risk is part of the game. You want to sit in that chair. You know, like it's so great. It's such a great last mission for Kirk because he's exhibiting all of the characteristics of what makes him a great commander in a real situation, you know, and effortlessly. So I love it. I can't say how much I love Kirk in this opening scene. So they do it. They go into the ribbon to the most part. Chekhov, you know, details a bunch of people to become medical staff because they don't have any kind of medical staff on board. And the joke is run out Tuesday. One ship is destroyed, and then they get 47 of the refugees off of the Lacul before it's destroyed out of 150. And of course, now the Enterprise B is in trouble. We flash briefly to the refugees, and we see Sorin, played by Malcolm McDowell, briefly, who's screaming, you know, I want to go back, I want to go back. And he's tranked. And we see Guinan there as well, which was, you know, a revelation that she would be there. I mean, she lives for an extremely long time, but kind of cool. So, you know, they do come up with a little tactical plan to discharge antimatter in front of the ship to break the ship free. They would normally do it with torpedoes, and we get back to the, you know, the trope of the torpedoes weren't delivered. So somebody has to go down to the deflector dish and change the configuration so they can do it. So I love this here. It's that... you know, Harriman right away is like, no, I'll go do it. And so he runs for the turbo lift, and Kirk sits in the command chair, and the camera zooms in on him, and he's like, yes, I'm back. And then in that moment, he realizes what's going on, and he's like, I'll do it. Your place is at the bridge of your ship, which is just great, you know. And so he goes down, and we get a tense, you know, minute and a half or 2 minutes of him going through Jeffrey's tubes and catwalks and does what has to be done, and they break free. But there's one last like whiplash of gravimetric energy, and we don't see what's going on. Now we experience it all through the bridge crew, and then we find that there's a hull breach, and D'Amore is mentioning the decks, and on the very last deck, she goes very quiet, and you realize that was the deck that Kirk was on. Scotty calls him, no answer, and so they all go down to the deck, and it's open to space. And it's a heart tugger of a moment as a Trek fan. Like I said, I mean, I like this death better than when he dies later on. I think this is just a really solid, I mean, it's not epic, right? You can't have this be at the end of a movie, but it's a really good death for Kirk. I don't know. He's exhibited so much of what we love about him in such a short space of time, and then made a really great decision and, you know, sacrificed himself unknowingly, right? But just so great. And so Scotty's there shot with Harriman, and then Chekhov walks in and he's like, my God, was anyone in here? And Scotty goes, I. And they slowly pan out and you see that it's open to space and it's only being covered by force fields. And we're out, you know, and it's just, it's a great opener, I tell you. I mean, it's just really tense, really good character. And all the characters are able to be, have their moments, you know, and Kirk's really great in it. And what I loved really is just, you know, man, you're in the hands of just old hand Trek writers. You know, they really just know the characters so well, and they effortlessly are allowed to, in the space of like 10-15 minutes, give us so much that we love about Trek, you know, in this sequence. So really love it. So we then jump to there's a title card on the screen 78 years later, and we're present at Worf's promotion. We don't know it's the holodeck yet. Of course, we join our next gen cast on this sailing ship, which seems to be back in, you know, the days of wooden ships and Iron Men, as they used to say. And it's next gen, and, you know, Worf's being promoted to lieutenant commander, which is cool. And it's great. The next gen cast is all there, you know. And so they have this thing where, you know, when they're mocking like he's going to be walking the plank for being a bad person. And of course, the charges read are all of the good things about Worf, and they promote him. And so he's got to jump up from this plank that's being extended out of the ship to grab what they call the badge of office, which is his hat. You know, we hear from Riker, no one's ever done it before. And of course, Worf does it. And there's this funny moment where You know, instead of saying retract the plank, which would have brought Worf back on board, Riker says, computer, remove the plank. And Worf falls in the water, and Picard's like, that's retract the plank. A great comedic timing where Riker kind of moves over to the edge and he looks down at Worf and he's like, sorry. So it's good. It's like early great comedy here, you know? And so now we're beginning, you know, what's great in this film is that Kirk, Picard, and Data all have character arcs, which is neat. And Data starts here, and that, you know, with Worf in the water, everyone's laughing and he doesn't understand. And so, you know, he's asking Crusher, what's the deal? And she's like, you have to be spontaneous. So he pushes her in the water. And everyone freaks out, and, you know, Geordi's like, that wasn't very funny. So we're beginning, you know, Data's kind of getting to a place in his life where he's like, I can't progress any further. So it starts off with an action, which I really like. But in this moment that ends us down, Picard gets the message. We don't know this yet, but he's called to get a personal message, and we watch his reaction as he reads it, and it's pretty intense, and he bails out of the ship right away and goes into the Enterprise. You know, we'll find out what that was later on, but something's going on with him. In the same moment, you know, the distress call from the Amagosa Observatory is gotten, and that they're being under attack, and so, you know, it's the Enterprise is not going to be on its first action of the story. We see Picard getting the information about the Amagosa when he's on the bridge, and you see he's not his usual self. Like, he doesn't want to be there. He's barking orders. He's telling Number One to handle it, and he kind of bolts into his ready room. So they get to the station. You know, there's really good tension. They beam over, and you know, they find Sorin there and a dead Romulan, so they know that somehow the Romulans are involved, and bring them back on board. No one really knows what the Romulans wanted. Sorin's the only one, I think, left alive. And so then we start with Data's arc, and Data and Geordi are talking. Data is like, you know, Geordi, I realize that all these years I'm trying to become more and more human, and I still can't understand a basic concept such as humor. And so we're introduced to the emotion chip, which he has devised in order to allow him to experience human emotions. And it kind of, it's a little bit dangerous. You know, Geordi's a little worried about it because it might overload his positronic relays and perhaps damage Data irrevocably. And as we come to know, Data is a one-of-a-kind android in the Star Trek universe. So, you know, something really terrible happens to him. Not much they can do about it. But Data is convinced that, you know, he's stuck. So it's, you know, he's not just going to, you know, continue sideways. He's going to go forward. And I love the Trek ethos is like part of the arc of this movie is you know, him growing as a human being. Like, how great, you know, very consciously, right, wanting to grow as a human being. So I love that. So immediately afterwards, then we have Data intent forward, and he has his emotion chip in, and there's this funny scene where he's ordering things to drink at the bar, and he drinks something, and he's not sure how to react to it, and then Guinan's like, it looks like he hates it, and he's like, yes, this is revolting. She's like, more? Please! You know, so another good comedic Trek moment, intent forward, really great. And then there's an interaction between Picard and Sorin, because Sorin's been calling for Picard all this time after he got off the station. And so he's like, Captain, you have to take me back to the Amagosa station. You know, there are some experiments that are running. I've spent 10 years, blah, 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 blah. Picard is very brusque. I understand your position. I'll see what I can do. But, you know, and then Sorin gets very mysterious. He's like, they say time is the fire in which we burn. And I know you know, Captain, what that means, whatever. So there's some little thing here that, you know, Sorin may know more about Picard than he thinks, or whatever. Something else is going on, and Picard definitely reacts visibly. We know later why he reacted in this way, but anyway, so he's kind of shaken and walks off. And, you know, whenever Malcolm McDowell and Patrick Stewart are on screen together, it's pretty great. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's almost like Stewart and Ian McKellen in the X-Men movies. You know, you have these two powerhouse actors in a genre movie, man. It really elevates the thing, you know. And I love McDowell. He's so good. He's a little amped in this. His performance is a little pushed in this film, but I still, I love him, and he's really good. And when him and Stewart are on screen, you're just like, oh, I'm watching a movie, you know, like, for real. We get a little bit of the information that they've discovered this trilithium that the Romulans are possibly trying to develop. You know, this experimental substance now that we hear about. And so Geordi and Data beam back to the station to do like a second set of reconnaissance. And now we get the beginnings of Data's new personality. And right now it's a little amped up. So he's laughing all the time and making jokes. And he's laughing now at a joke that was told in the first episode of Next Generation and the Farpoint mission. you know, which I think is kind of fun. Like, you know, he has to catch up now on all the humor that he's been around for the past 7+ years. So he's like, he's just getting that joke and he's laughing. He does this bit where he opens the secret door and with his polarizing sort of his positronic relays, and he says, "Open sesame." Mr. Tricorder is this little hand puppet, you know. So he's like, he's riffing and joking all throughout this whole thing, and you can see Geordi kind of getting, you know, he's trying to be patient, but he's getting a little peeved at, like, you know, how flippant Data is. And then there's this great moment where Data can't stop laughing, and he's like, "I think something is wrong," and he malfunctions and collapses. And then Soren appears out of nowhere, winds up knocking Geordi out. Data, for the first time in his life, can't perform his duties. He's scared to death. And so when Soren points the gun at him, he's scared to death. He's like, "Please don't kill me. Please don't hurt me," which is amazing to see, you know. So again, we have Data experiencing his first set of real raw fear. And then we have this, we cut away to Picard and Counselor Troi. She finally pushes past his reticence about what's going on. And I really love this scene. It can be kind of weird, but I really love it anyway, that, you know, we find out that his brother and his nephew died in a fire, you know. You know, Picard starts to cry. It's so funny. It's like, it's not a, there are some really good, like, movie cries, right, where actors cry in a cool way, where, like, they weep and it's, like, cool in some ways, or, like, it's cinematically correct. And Stewart doesn't do that. Stewart cries, his head shakes, his shoulders shake a little bit. He just out and out, like, seems to weep in the scene. And at first you're like, this is weird, because he's so unmanned by it, you know, like he's so, you know, sometimes when men cry, but they cry masculinely, you know, like, but Picard is very, like, I don't know, it's really neat what Stewart does here. Like, he's really just unabashedly weeping and screwed up over this. So I really like it, and it's really weird at the same time. I don't know, it's a really odd thing, but I do love this line of, like, he's crying because he's thinking about all the experiences that Rene is never going to have. Like, he's never going to graduate from the academy. He's never going to listen to music or fall in love, or, you know, just these baseline human experiences that people have in their life, that his life was cut short, you know, and he's never going to go through all that. And it's, I think when I watch it too, I think it's very affecting. And I think Stewart really makes it affecting for me because of how powerful he's impacted by it. In retrospect, think about this. This is a long, by movie standards, a pretty long scene of character building. Like, you know, what are we talking about? We're spending this time, it's not the story, you know, we're not doing story points, we're not, like, learning all this stuff and doing more story information. This is just Picard and him processing his brother's death in front of, like, an old dear friend, you know. And how amazing is that, you know, to do that in a you know, major motion picture like that, which is just, you know, you're in the hands of real Trek writers who know the characters, and this is how they think about story from a television point of view, where you got to keep it close to character, because that's, you know, ultimately what TV is about for the most part. You don't have tons of production budget and to do massive effects, right? So it's got to be about the people. And they bring that to the screen. So I really love what they do here.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, it's $4 a week, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi On Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi-on-screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, blah, blah.
One interesting note about this is that Stewart was aided in his portrayal of Picard's grief, having read the script for a film he was about to do called Jeffrey, which was released the following year. And he was reading it on set, and he had said it touched him so extremely deeply that it actually allowed him to get into his grief. And I hadn't seen the movie Jeffrey, so I don't really know much of what it's about, but I thought that was really interesting. So ending the Picard scene is the impact of Soren's torpedo on the Amagosa star. And Geordi and Data are still on board the station. So great tension, you know, an away team beams over to sort of find out what's happened to them. And as they're over there and, you know, people are shooting back, Soren's shooting back at them, and a Klingon bird of prey decloaks, which is, you know, the stakes are upped, which is really fascinating. And of course, you know, Soren holds them off long enough to beam to the bird of prey and take Geordi with him. So we get a brief scene on the Klingon bird of prey, and we're introduced to two old loved characters from Next Gen, the Duras sisters, Lursa and Betor. I'm probably mispronouncing the second name, but I remember them from two or three episodes of Next Gen. They're awesome. So it's great to see them back, and they're obviously in league with Soren, talking about, you know, this is a trilithium weapon that Soren is developing for them in exchange for, you know, I guess time and materials to build his stuff. When we cut back to the Enterprise now, we get a little background on Soren, that he's 300 years old. He's an Elorian, and they live very long, and he was a refugee on, and now we hear the, you know, the these characters name check the beginning of the film. He was, his ship was the one rescued by the Enterprise B on the mission that Kirk died, right? So it kind of brings us full circle. But we also find out that they remember that there was also another passenger on board who we also know. And so we cut to a Picard Guinan scene. This is the first now we're hearing about the Nexus, which is the ribbon. And we're hearing all about that. That's where the ships were. She was in there, and Soren and everyone on that shuttle were, you know, were trapped inside the Nexus. And she describes it to Picard as like being inside joy. Whatever your greatest desire, whatever the thing you wish for the most comes true. You're, you know, you live inside of your wildest dreams. So very intriguing of what's to come. And, you know, we get this threatening tag, which they don't pay off on later, unfortunately. But she's like, you know, you won't care about the mission. You won't care about anything. All you'll care about is getting back to the ribbon. And, you know, yes, that's true for Soren. And, you know, Guinan, you can tell, was like, she even says to Picard, like, I've spent most of my life trying to forget it. It was a huge thing for me to walk away from. And that, you know, Kirk and Picard have very little trouble overcoming it. Kind of belittles it later on, but I'll get to that. So now we have this great scene, another really great character scene on board the Enterprise, which I love. It's with Data and Picard in stellar cartography. And we find out that the emotion chip has now been fused to Data's neural net. So he's in, you know, he's kind of by all intents and purposes human at this point, because the chip now can't be removed, you know, without a major, major, you know, deconstruction of his systems. So, you know, first of all, we're dealing with Data's character that at some point he wants to walk away from helping Picard. You know, Picard's asking him to plot stuff on the map. And what, you know, and he's like, sir, I want to be relieved of duty. I no longer want these emotions. I wish to be shut down. First, Picard tries empathy. And he's like, Data, you know, this is what it means to be human. And Data's like, I want him out. And then Picard has to try the stick. And he's like, you will do your duty as is requested of you. And I love that Picard gets tough with him. Because in a weird way, Data's now kind of like a child in a sense of his feelings. And Picard kind of, you know, sternly upbraids him as you know, parents are wont to do from time to time. It has an effect on Data. Data kind of shakes it off for a minute. And he's like, yes, sir. And it helps to focus him. And we see that, which is really cool. And obviously, what's great about the two character arcs of these two characters is that, you know, Data wants to get rid of his emotions. And Picard would love to get rid of his too. I mean, he's, you know, he's suffering massive grief over the death of... So, you know, even though he has sympathy for Data, he also is struggling to maintain his own poise. So, I don't know. I thought that was really clever by the writers to have these two parallel stories. And, you know, they know the character so well that it's like effortless that these two stories are parallel and interacting thematically. So, I love that. So, then we get the great use of stellar cartography in Soren's plan. And I love this. You know, the whole idea that, you know, Picard starts the investigation by saying, you know, what are all the things that happened with the Amagosa star being destroyed? And so they're reading off this list of things. One minor, seemingly minor effect catches Picard's eye, like, well, where Data says the starship Bozeman was required to make a course correction. And so the reveal is that the gravitational map of the whole sector has changed subtly with the disappearance of that star. And so they use this to, like, where's the ribbon now? Where's it going? Is it going near any Class M planets? They find out that it's going near the Viridium system and that it's, like, very close to Viridian 3. And then Picard asks Data to plot. And it's great. They're zooming in on the planets and the systems. And it looks, the graphics are so great. And we understand exactly what's going on. You know, even if you're not into science or you're not, you know, technically minded, I can't imagine that you'd have a problem with the layout of the story. Like, done so well. And I get goosebumps every time when Picard's like, you know, what happens if the Viridian sun were to, you know, were to disappear the way the Amagosa star did, and Data plots the change in gravitation of the system, and you see the line of the ribbon move right onto Viridian 3. And it's just, I don't know, as a sci-fi fan, I geek out on that shit. I think it's great, you know? It's just like, you know, Sauron's plan is to sort of deactivate stars to alter. Well, that's like a wonderful, I mean, if you're going to be a mastermind bad guy, that's a hell of a scope. You know, it's pretty epic of like, I'm taking out stars to reroute the course of something that I need to get to in the system. Like, I don't know. I think that is so cool. And it's such a great scene where we see it all play out. So I really love that. And obviously the call, the tag now is that there are 230 million people on like a pre-industrial Viridian 4, I believe. If he blows up the star, they're gone. So we got some stakes. So then there's a brief scene back on the Bird of Prey. Ursa and Bator basically ask him, you know, what did you get out of Geordi? And he says, nothing. His heart just wasn't into it. And so it's a reference to a form of torture used in a deleted scene in which Sauron used a nanoprobe to stop and start LaForge's heart, I guess, torturing him in some way. This is also a reference in a later scene in which Dr. Crusher mentions that she had removed the nanoprobe. So I was always confused later when she's like, I removed the nanoprobe, and we're like, what nanoprobe? So it's a scene of him being tortured that was cut, which is weird. I guess it would have been a little hardcore for, you know, our beloved Geordi to get tortured. So odd that scene came out, I guess. Of course, the Enterprise gets there. The Bird of Prey is there cloaked, but they know they're there. So there's this gambit now. They're on screen speaking to each other. They know they're there. And basically Picard is saying, you know, I'll exchange myself for Geordi, but you got to beam me down to the planet, because basically that's where Sauron is. So the exchange is done. And then next we cut down to Viridian 3. And it's Viridian 3 reminds me of like so many alien planets in the Trek universe, mostly barren and rocky, easy to film, you know, no permits, right? You can just show up, put your camera there, and you can film a scene. I was looking for that very distinguishable rock formation that we've seen in the original series from time to time, that thing that kind of goes up. It almost looks like a straight line that goes up at an angle. You know what I'm talking about if you're an original series fan, like that rock formation that, you know, every other alien planet scene is filmed on. So, but of course, was not there. So then there's a really good comedy where, you know, part of what happened was that Sauron does a little work on LaForge's visor, and so it's transmitting images back to the Bird of Prey. And so we get Lursa and Bator's commentary as Geordi's walking around, and it starts off with when he wakes up and sees Crusher. You know, you pan over to the two, and they're like, oh, human females are so repulsive. It's just it's so great. So great Trek humor. And later they're impatient with Geordi, like, where is he now? He's gone to get dinner. And they're like, he's the only engineer in Starfleet who never goes to engineering. It's like, yeah. So it's really good. Really good shark humor. And then we have a scene between Data and Geordi, because Geordi's back. And Data is like, Geordi, you know, I behaved horribly. And Geordi's like, no, Data, you behaved like a human. You know, because he's apologizing that he froze and he was unable to disarm Sauron, which, you know, had he not had his emotion chip, he pretty much would have taken Sauron out, most likely. It's a great scene because near the end of the scene when Geordi tells him, no, you're behaving like a human, you see this little half smile come on Data's face. And like, no, he's growing as a character. It's just so great to see. And then we cut down to the planet. So now we're cutting back and forth to build tension. We're cutting down to the planet where Picard and Sauron are having a dialogue. Obviously, we're cutting to the Bird of Prey as they're watching Geordi. And so Picard and Sauron have their first dialogue. You know, Sauron's behind a force field tinkering with his last minute, you know, his rocket and the little platform where he's going to go up into the Nexus. And it's great. You know, two really good actors on screen with pretty good dialogue, you know, talking about time. And Picard is like, when you do this, you're going to blow up the other planet in the system that contains all these people, like kind of like the Borg did to your planet. And Sauron looks at him. He's like, nice try, Captain, you know. But Sauron is too far gone. And, you know, Picard can't really talk him out of it. And he's like, you know, time is a predator. It's stalking you. And I found a place where time has no teeth. There is no time there. And I don't care about anything else but getting back there. And everybody dies. And so pretty much Sauron is like, you know, he's completely single-minded, and Picard tried to appeal to his humanity and has, you know, failed. So then you get Brent Spiner's life form song, which is just so awesome. They're on the bridge of the Enterprise, and they're trying to scan the surface for signs of the captain, and they can't. And so he's, you know, Data goes into his little life forms bit, which is just really great. And finally, you know, when Geordi gets to engineering, he looks at the main engineering screen, which shows the status of the ship. And, you know, Lursa and Bator finally freeze it. And we see that the shield is modulating at a certain frequency, which I think is very clever. And if they dial that frequency into some of the fields surrounding the torpedoes, they can just kind of slip right through the shields as if they weren't there. So really great little intrigue here about the shields. I really like that. And as soon as they figure it out, they just start blasting away, and the Enterprise is just taking hits left and right. And, you know, it's okay in terms of the bridge and, you know, the running around and jumping and the action shots, which is, you know, we're used to in the Trek universe. During all this, Riker asks Worf, are there any vulnerabilities in these old Bird of Preys? And these plasma coils are vulnerable, which is why they've taken out of service, you know. So this is the whole, you know, the Star Trek tech universe. So they're figuring out, you know, how they're going to do this. And we're cutting back to the planet, and Picard finds a hole in the shield for Sorin, and this little hole in the rocks, and he slips through at the same time. But then we cut back to the ship, and so we get this great end of the battle where they cause the ship to cloak, which drop, you know, the plasma coils. They do something. They generate some pulse around it, and the ship automatically cloaks, drops the shields, and they blast it away. So it's really good, and, you know, it's a really good, satisfying moment when the ship blows. So even though they beat the Bird of Prey, the damage they suffered from the explosion and from the battle is a warp core breach. As Trek fans, we all know that that's bad news. So they have to evacuate, and they do a saucer separation, which is great because they've only done it at Farpoint. And I think it's so funny, you know, the saucer was designed from way back, and even the first Trek that separates in danger, and they only did it once, and they do it again. So they separate the saucer section, which is kind of cool. Then there's a long section. It's a little too long. I mean, it's good that the saucer section is separating because it's a good escalation where they got to get off the ship. But once they're, you know, the crash landing on the planet takes a little bit of a long time. Now, by the time it touches down, you're like, all right, already. Pretty much everyone survives. It's a bumpy landing, but they're down. And then we shift over to Picard and Sorin. Basically, Picard gets inside the shield, and there's this confrontation on a catwalk where he's blocking Sorin getting to where he needs to go. And, of course, Picard loses the fight. It's a fist fight. And, you know, throughout most of the show, right, Picard's not Kirk. He's not the macho fighter. Like, he's the strategy guy. He's a tough dude. It comes to pass that Picard is too late. The rocket goes off, and the sun sort of goes. You know, then we're in for, like, yet another mega destruction scene. We just had one, and this is the blast wave destroying the planet. And ostensibly, you know, everybody. But right before that, you know, we're standing, we see the ribbon is, the energy ribbon is completely drenching that whole area. So we realize Picard and Sorin are heading into the ribbon, and they go into the Nexus, right? Think about this. I mean, you know, the Nexus is basically only, there is no place, there's no Nexus. There is no, like, welcome to the Nexus. It's only the point of view of your own bliss, right? And it's an incredible scene. We open up, it's like a Christmas scene, and he's surrounded by his children and his wife, Earl Grey, a cup of Earl Grey love. You know, like, it's Picard's dream come true. His nephew is there, Renee. His reaction to it is just heartbreaking, especially Renee. Like, they all go into the other room briefly, and he calls Renee over, and he hugs him, and he's crying. Like, it's beautiful, you know? And I just have to take an aside here. This is where Trek differs from Star Wars. You know, where else would you see this kind of an unconventional plot point or plot idea in a major motion picture? You know, what purports to be a space adventure, that really this part of it, they're continuing into deeper character studies of the characters. So, like, no, this isn't the Death Star. They're not rescuing people. And look, I knock Star Wars versus Star Trek, but I love Star Wars. I'm a huge fan of the universe. But what I try to underline where I can is where Trek is different, because not a lot of people who are not Trekkies understand how Trek is different. To them, it's just like there's a hand signal and a guy with the pointy ears, and, you know, they're still blowing up ships and they have villains. And it's like, no, it's not. It's stuff like this where the main, you know, climax of the movie is this character goes into his own bliss and what that means to him and whether he's going to stay and all. I just, I don't know. It's This movie has its problems, but it's so impressive that this is the main thing. A lot of people complain. They think the Nexus is bogus. They don't like it. I love it, man. I love that they choose to do character stuff as the main point in this movie. Just really impressive. And we've been prepped for this moment by the film. We followed Picard's journey here with, you know, talking about family. The thread even started with Kirk in the preview of, like, how did he have time for a family? And Picard's family dies. He's crying about it. He's upset about it. We hear all about Renee, and he talks about with Troy about the family going on, and there would always be a Picard. So I felt relieved about that. So, like, there's some deep stuff that when this happens and he's got his full family around him, we're with him 100% because we've been brought here by the writers, you know? So it's really amazing. Now, unfortunately, the flip side of that is he snaps out of it way too quickly. As he's looking at the Christmas tree, he's seeing these little, you know, inside some of the Christmas ornaments, you know, what look like kind of stars going nova. And he's immediately pulled out. And then Guinan appears out of nowhere to explain to the audience and to him, this is the Nexus. Everyone's is different. It's what you've always wanted. So we're getting this whole explanation about things. And immediately he, you know, he realizes it's not real and he needs to leave. And so, you know, we're prepped to see how amazing this is. And we do for a second do feel it of like, wow, this is Picard's dream come true. But he tosses it aside very, very quickly, you know. So it's I have a little tough time with that. You know, what we're taking away here from this too is that Guinan tells him, if you leave the Nexus, you can go anywhere, anytime. So, you know, this is the one Achilles heel in this film. Like, if you're going to do time travel, oh, beware. Because if Reddit existed back then, it would have blown up with, you have the ability to go anywhere, anytime. You go back minutes before the last possible moment that you could go back. And that's where you go back, you know. So, like, you just have to swallow it, you know, that you wouldn't go back when they picked up Sauron, you know, initially from the, or before the ammo goes to Star, like, save that Star, whatever. The most egregious problem, though, is that he wouldn't go back in time and save his brother and his nephew. I mean, that doesn't even occur to him here, that not only could he save the Viridian star system and stop Sauron with ease, he could also save his brother and his nephew. And that this, you know, it's a huge plot hole. But again, you know, when you're playing with time travel, you open up all this kind of stuff. And if you haven't thought it through and covered all the bases, you're dead meat. So it's just, you have to just deal with the fact that this is the trope. And Picard's like, you know, chooses to go back in time, you know, a few minutes, whatever. So there you have it. So then you have, you know, what should be a pretty significant and amazing thing. It's like, you know, in the film Heat, when De Niro and Pacino had coffee, right? You were like riveted to the moment. You were like, oh my God, these two screen legends came on. And it was a very lame kind of letdown of a scene. And I feel like this is very similar. Kirk's just weird throughout this whole thing. It's like he's not listening to Picard. He's all spaced out. And yeah, obviously, you know, he just showed up in the Nexus, so he doesn't know what's going on. He hasn't been prepped for it like Picard has via Guinan, right? So yes, you can explain it, but it's just weird, you know, that he's just not listening to Picard and he's so spaced out, possibly thinking that Picard is part of the deal and not knowing what's going on. Anyway, but I don't like that Picard's kind of hectoring him. Picard's following him around. Captain, you got to do this, you got to do that. You know, come on. And Captain's like, hey, I'm not, don't lecture me. At one point, they actually engage with each other. And he's like, I was out saving the galaxy when your grandfather was in diapers. The galaxy owes me one. So there's like a moment of lucidity. He's actually very Shatner in this whole scene. And I don't like it. I don't know. It's like there's nothing gritty or chewy here. It's just weird, you know, and just kind of odd. So a few things, some trivia about this scene is that Shatner's riding the horse, that it's actually, this whole thing was filmed on his horse farm. The horses are his. He's actually a pretty amazing horseman. And you can tell because they shoot a scene where he and Picard are on horseback. You know, there's a scene where he sort of rides slowly around Picard, and then he moves his horse sideways towards Picard, which would probably be a very difficult thing to do if you knew how to, if you, you know, for riding. And of course, you know, it must be Shatner's favorite horse. He probably knows it. There's a lot really showing, like, look at Kirk's horsemanship. And I'm like, that's Shatner, you know, it's really kind of funny. And then there's Antonia, his supposed love interest at this point. She was originally conceived as Carol Marcus, so she was going to be Carol Marcus, which would have been kind of interesting to have that tie back, but Paramount requested that the character be changed. Who knows why? So they do this thing where, again, and like Picard, he tires the Nexus far too easily, you know, so he jumps his horse over a ravine a couple of times, and then he's like, you know, I've done that jump 100 times, but this time was different. I didn't feel anything because it isn't real. Immediately, he realizes the Nexus is not real, so he turns to Picard, and he's like, all right, you know, what's the deal? Picard lays it out to him, and he's like, who am I to argue with the captain of the Enterprise? Shatner said that was like the hardest line he's ever had to say. In any of his, you know, any of his scenes in film and TV, because he's really, it's a passing of the baton for real for him. So I thought that was interesting. Absurdness of bringing Kirk back to fistfight Sorin, that happens, right? So there's this whole last moment of Sorin now fighting both Kirk and Picard. And of course, you know, they're up and down. You know, there's a bunch of stuff about the keypad that controls the launcher. And so Picard gets to the launcher because Kirk beats the crap out of Sorin. And he engages the docking clamps and, you know, Sorin blows up with the rocket, which never launches. But, of course, Kirk falls via this catwalk, which finally lets go. And so he falls basically to his death. You know, you have Kirk's death scene, supposedly, but there's some more to tell later that, you know, if they really wanted to, this wouldn't have to be his death scene. But they have this scene where he's like, did we win? We won. And it was fun. And then, oh my. And he's dead, you know. Captain Kirk is dead. And it was really weird and anticlimactic in an odd way. I don't know. I really liked Kirk's death in the early part of the movie because it just, I don't know, there was something so wonderfully heroic about it. And to have a fistfight with Sorin, I mean, it's just weird. I don't think any of the fans really loved it. I don't give the writers too much grief about it because part of me thinks, like, how does Captain Kirk actually die? In what scenario would you set up a death scene for Kirk where we wouldn't be disappointed? Like, what death scene is going to satisfy, you know, the most ardent fan who's been with the show since, like, the original series in the 60s? You'd have to save, like, the multiverse, you know what I mean? And yet, at the same time, you know, beating up Sorin and falling from a catwalk and, you know, saving a system, I don't know. I think it's too big for me. I think Kirk's death in terms of whether it was good or not, it's too big for me to put my arms around. I don't know what I would want in a death for Kirk. I only know that I really liked the way he died in the beginning of the film. I felt more poignant about it. When Picard is standing over his cairn here, I'm not that moved, and that bothers me more than anything. That, you know, I'm not supremely moved that Kirk is dead. I just feel kind of odd about it. A little bit of trivia about the death scene here. They originally shot it where Sorin shoots Kirk in the back and he dies. And then Sorin is shot by Picard. And the preview audience reacted really badly, wanting a more heroic death for Kirk. They had to go back and do reshoots, which was interesting. I didn't know about this. So they, you know, the writers had to go back and rejigger the ending and figure out how they were going to do this. And they had to go back, and it was like a $5 million reshoot. Like, it cost a lot of money. They had to bring a bridge out to these rocks. And even Brennan Braga and Ron Moore themselves are not too satisfied about his death. I guess they wrote themselves into a corner and they tried to get out as best they can, but I don't think they cracked it. And neither did they, frankly. One little bit is Kirk's final words, oh my, were a spontaneous ad-lib made by Shatner, and he explained it later that it was Kirk's reaction to eternity and truly going where Kirk had never gone before, which is kind of interesting. So once Kirk is buried, the shuttle comes for Picard, and we have this last scene where they're picking up personal items from the destroyed Enterprise-D. One little note about that, they destroyed the Enterprise-D partially because it was designed for narrow aspect ratio and low resolution of TV. So it was created for 4:3 aspect ratio. And, you know, they were shooting back in the 90s and, you know, digital video. And this was the same model that was used. And so being able to destroy it, they were able to build a brand new one, which was sort of more motion picture friendly. Supposedly, the lighting used for motion pictures, like the lights are hotter and more intense, and it wasn't designed for that. So there were a little bit of difficulty shooting it. But that they designed, you know, the Enterprise E, I guess. I don't know. I assumed it was fully CGI, but I guess they built an E model. For the subsequent films, it was much more, you know, motion picture friendly. So that was kind of interesting. We get the kind of capstones of Data and Picard's arcs. You know, Data finds Spot. his cat. And it's a sweet scene. He starts crying and Troy is there. And he's like, you know, why am I crying? And, you know, it's I'm happy. Why am I crying? And so, you know, in a sense, Data is he's becoming more and more human now. He's leaving the emotion chip in. He's going to try to deal with his feelings. It's great. And Picard and Riker are picking through the debris and he picks up the photo album that he was earlier showing to Deanna, which has all the pictures of his brother and Renee. You know, he kind of makes his peace a little bit. That, you know, you really need to live for the moment and that these times never come again. And unlike Sorin, who was saying time is a predator, you know, he liked to think that Picard likes to think that time is a companion on the journey through life, which is, you know, kind of a nice ending. So, you know, the shuttle comes and off they go and the film ends. So I have to say, I have a soft spot in my heart for Generations. And I think it's because of the focus on the actors and that the Nexus is actually a character device to explore character. And I love Data's arc. I love Kirk in the beginning of the movie. I think that's such a wonderful death, a wonderful way of him going out. I love that whole sequence. I love seeing the two Klingons from the TV show. The plot is very interesting about the ribbon and the suns being destroyed. There's just a lot of really sure direction and dialogue, and the story is really great. You know, things kind of fall apart really once kind of Picard goes into the Nexus. I think from then on out, once you start getting time travel involved and, you know, the scenes between him and Kirk and the fist fight and the end, you know, it's very unsatisfying, the last third of it. And they kind of wrote themselves into a corner. But still, when it ends, I give credit to the film that even when the film ends with that problem, I still feel like very satisfied emotionally for the story, even for Kirk's arc a little bit, you know, that he, in a sense, you know, he did have his heroic end. He had two of them. Picard had his moment at Bliss and turned it down. And, you know, Data becoming fully human. And I don't know. There's just something about all that that by the end of the movie, I felt it gel together for me as a Star Trek fan. And I'm definitely biased about Star Trek films because I really am a huge fan of the franchise. So I go a little easy on the movies at times. Like, I'm not too easy on 3 and 5. You know, for the most part, I recognize a lot of criticisms about this film. And I totally, you know, I buy it. A lot of people don't like Generations for a lot of reasons. They like First Contact better. And, you know, arguably First Contact is probably a better movie overall. But there's something about Generations that just, I don't know. I'm sentimentally attached to it. Let's put it that way. So one interesting bit of trivia here. I don't have much trivia on this. I kind of salted most of it in. The Nexus and the aspect of the Nexus that Guinan was talking about where, you know, you can leave anytime, anywhere, and that Guinan was there and Guinan was also in the world was something that they built into the script because basically the Kirk in the Nexus is eternal. And he can leave the Nexus at any time. I think the rules are that if he's in this universe and the Nexus, it can only be one in the universe. And, you know, your Echo is in the Nexus. But if you die in this universe, I get the impression that you can just kind of be reborn. If you know about it in the Nexus, you can just kind of come back into the world. So, you know, if Generations happened to be a huge runaway hit, the powers that be realized it was because Kirk and Picard were together. You would have seen Generations 2, The Return of Kirk, like in a heartbeat. You know, so what happened is that it spawned an entire side world of novels, which us in the franchise know called the Shatnerverse novels. So basically, right after Generations, well, the first Shatnerverse novel actually starts before it leads up to his mission on the Enterprise B. So there's a whole thing about the Enterprise B. And by the second novel, however, Kirk reappears out of the Nexus again, and he's captured by the Romulans. And they, you know, they bring him back, and they wipe his brain and put new memories in. And, you know, there's a whole thing about him, you know, being used to go back into the Federation and assassinate people. So there's like 6 or 7 books of what's called the Shatnerverse. I think I read at some point. I probably read the first two, and they're very entertaining. If you're in a mood for just a light read, and I don't know, something about Generations, you like Kirk and Picard doing shit together. The Shatnerverse novels are, you know, not a terrible way to spend an afternoon, but I thought it was very interesting that a whole raft of novels would come out of the sequel, of non-canon sequel to this film. So very interesting. So that's about it. I'm going to be covering the J.J. Abrams Trek movies in the weeks leading up to Star Trek 3. Then I'm going to continue on every once in a while to continue finishing out the Trek movies. I will do Insurrection and Nemesis and have the entire Trek franchise on my webpage listed under the index. So anyway, hope you enjoyed this podcast and I'll see you next time.